Matt Bobala with you, 720 WGN Radio. We're live from the Allstate Showcase Studio in the historic Tribune Tower building. At roughly 67 million years old, Sue the T-Rex is about to participate in her first space odyssey. This is out of the Chicago Tribune a couple of days ago. Microbes collected from the Field Museum's popular dinosaur skeleton are slated to be launched into space as early as next month as part of a scientific effort known as Project Mercury or not, because it's not spelled like you would normally spell Mercury. We'll find out in a second. The project will study how 48 microorganisms from different places on Earth compare to each other and to those already found on the International Space Station, which is its ultimate destination. The project, which involves thousands of people nationwide, was spearheaded by an organization called the Science Cheerleader, a group of current and former NFL and NBA cheerleaders who are pursuing science and technology careers. The group specifically requested Sue's participation in the study, prompting a Field Museum paleontologist to swab the surface of her bones. Sue just has that magical appeal, said Darlene Cavalier, the founder of Science Cheerleader and a former cheerleader for the Philadelphia 76ers. The symmetry is beautiful. An old T-Rex involved in research at the space station. Joining us on the phone right now, in fact, is Darlene Cavalier. Hey, Darlene, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for staying up so late with us.
My pleasure.
No, it's not. You're like, for God's sakes, I should have been in bed an hour ago. But fine, I'll do it.
I'm saying that with my teeth gritting.
Well, thank you. All right, so there are a million different questions just from what I've read here. First of all, the microbes from Sue, of course, aren't microbes from, like, Sue's time. It's whatever's going on at the Field Museum right now, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. And now I don't have the specific bacteria that we found on Sue in front of us. I think it was referenced in that article, though. But it was fascinating enough that the researchers at UC Davis, they're the ones who do the culturing of the microbes from what we call surface samples, and that was a surface sample. They look for a diverse representative set of really cool microbes or bacteria to send to the International Space Station as part of this research program. So whatever was lurking on Sue was cool enough to be selected as one of the 48 microbes that are heading to space.
The dinosaurs' microbes were then examined at the University of California, Davis, where scientists determined the skeleton had traces of, prepare for it, people, because I'm sure I'm going to butcher it, Paneobacillus mucilaginosus.
Pretty good.
That was pretty bad, wasn't it? You can be honest. It's late at night. You can tell me. Can you say that, or do you know what I just said?
No, but I can tell you that each bacteria that was selected to head to the space station does have its own trading card. So if any of your listeners go to spacemicrobes.org and click on microbe cards, they can find a nice description about the microbes that we found on Sue, why we think it's awesome, and a little fun fact about that.
Why we think those microbes are awesome. All right, yeah. So the microbes that were off Sue, which I can't pronounce, are a widely used agriculture fertilizer. So do we think that a bunch of farmers are going to see Sue at the Field Museum and touching her, or are these from where they dug her up? It was, you know, stuff that's been planted, you know, thrown on Earth for a long time. Why do we think that microbe was on Sue?
So, no, it's part of the mystery. I mean, the other part of this research project, by the way, so we have 48 samples that are heading to space, but then we have another 4,000 samples that are collected, mostly from shoes and cell phones. And part of that research is to answer some of those questions. We won't have empirical evidence to say for sure that, you know, a farmer tracked that into Sue, but what we hope to have is a nice baseline of information from these 4,000 samples comparing cell phone samples. So we presume that's your cell phone and it stays with you, as opposed to your shoes, which are tracked all over the place. We'll be looking at the differences in the cell phone and shoe samples that we collect at different locations on different dates. And in fact, again, on spacemicrobes.org, in about, in about 2 months, you can go to that site and you'll be able to see, visualize the data. So you'll be able to see, you know, what we're finding in the Chicago area. On people's cell phones and shoes.
All right, Darlene, let's take a call real quick because Joe says this is scaring him a little bit. Joe, you're on 720 WGN. What do you want to say?
Yeah, just, you know, thinking about series number 1, 2, and 3, and they were sending microbes up in the space or bringing them back, if you will. Is there a possibility that could reoccur? And I was planning on listening a lot more to hear your superb definition of what the accomplishments will be. But, you know, it reminded me of species.
Species. All right, hold on, Joe. Listen in, and Darlene will tell us if we're worried that, Darlene, are we going to set off a worldwide disaster here by sending microbes into space?
God, I hope not. I mean, one of the reasons that UC Davis researchers out of the Eisen Lab, their role is super important. So they screen these microbes first. We send them there. They culture them. They make sure there's no pathogens there. And this is part of our agreement with, of course, with NASA and two companies that made this research possible. One is Space Florida, and the other is NanoRex. So everybody has a plays a role in screening these microbes. You know, nothing scary gets sent on the International Space Station. We also have to think about, you know, the safety of the astronauts that are there. They'll actually be doing research on these microbes on the International Space Station. So part of the other reason why SUSE microbes were selected, that particular strain was selected, is because it's not something that would harm people in space. And now to your other point, we will be asking the astronauts on the space station to swab the inside of the space station. What we want to do is compare what a carefully controlled environment that is floating around, you know, in a near zero gravity environment there, what the microbial makeup is of that International Space Station compared to other areas that we've been swabbing, which are the furthest thing you can imagine from a tightly controlled environment, including the New England Patriots Stadium, the 76ers Stadium, and where we have thousands and thousands of people interacting, you know, in non-controlled ways.
Yeah. New England, very non-controlled ways. But when we talk about the space station and the microbes there, I'm going to sound really dumb here, but all those microbes, any microbes at the space station would be brought by humans or human touch or from, you know, there's not microbes gathering there from space, or would there be?
Could be. I mean, in order for the, I don't think that's going to be a problem, I should tell you, because even the payload integration, we have learned from the number of times that our launch has been pushed back, how careful NASA is with everything that goes into the International Space Station, including the payload. So in addition to these microbe samples, you know, there's something like, I think, 5,000 pounds of supplies going to those astronauts on the International Space Station. So I think it's unlikely that there's any kind of contaminant going in there. In fact, one of the launches was scrubbed because they did find evidence of some kind of contaminant, and they wouldn't allow it. They wouldn't allow this to be boarded onto SpaceX,
sure,
which is how this payload actually gets to the International Space Station. So I just find it highly unlikely.
My question is not about the payload headed up there. It's about microbes in space. Not the microbes you're sending, but in space itself. Would any microbes, I know it would be on the outside of the space station, they don't get to open the doors and just let air in, but are there microbes floating around in space that are traceable, or is that just a land-based thing on the different planets?
I don't, you know, we'll have to ask the UC Davis researchers about that. I know for their specific purposes, remember, this is part of the Eisen Lab, and they're very, very focused on what's called the built environment. So they're specifically looking for microbes in buildings. They look at the International Space Station as a perfect test bed for this because it's a very large building floating out in space that has a different environment than what we'll be able to collect and test here.
But like the buildings you're doing here, like it, you know, where the Patriots play, that's an indoor outdoor building, people coming in and out. So let's add this, just add this to the list. They won't even notice that you wrote it on. So when you send up the microbes, say, hey, by the way, you're going to swab the inside, then just write, you know, number two, next spacewalk, swab the outside.
I'll add that on my list of the things for the astronauts to do.
Wouldn't that be totally cool, though? I mean, wouldn't you love a swab of the outside and see, well, is there anything on there? Or, you know, there's space debris, there's little things, there's something floating in the air sometimes, right?
Sure.
And maybe there's something out there.
Yes, it's a good question. It's a great research question.
Is it really, or are you just making fun of me?
No, I think it sounds amazing.
Okay.
I love it.
All right, so write that down, see if they'll do it. You know, it's NASA.
Okay,
they, you know, they're loving publicity. They need more publicity. They need more positive publicity. So maybe they'll be like, hey, that's a cool idea.
They might. They seem to really like this project. We've been having a lot of fun, you know, engaging the public in collecting these samples, some that go towards what's called the Earth microbiome map. So that is where we collect those 4,000 samples.
Mm-hmm.
That actually goes – that the Chicago area plays a huge role in that. Those are being sequenced at Argonne National Lab there by a researcher named Jack Gilbert. He's really an important factor in this. He takes those 4,000 samples that we send in. He does some rapid sequencing, and he produces the data that we then share on that interactive map. He's really one of the leaders of that Earth microbiome project, mapping microbes across the Earth.
Now, Sue, I know
it goes back to Chicago. Yeah,
Darlene, I know that you just said that NASA does really like this project. They're really into this. Are they really, or are they really into hanging out with former cheerleaders?
Well, I should clarify. So this isn't quite a NASA project. This is the NanoRacks and Space Florida that really made this possible, this payload integration onto the International Space Station. I think there are plenty of people who like hanging out with cheerleaders. The point about NASA is more that what we're able to do through this project is not just due to public engagement, teaching the public what a microbe is, getting them to understand that, that International Space Station that we all invested lots of money in is out there. It's alive. It's kicking. It's got a lot of research going on up there. And even just the fact that, you can see the International Space Station with your naked eye. NASA has a great website, and I'll have to look it up. But it's basically, if you look up Spot the Station.
Yeah, you can find out when it's going to fly over your house, because
yes.
The trajectory changes all the time. And there are a lot of times they'll come right through Chicago at night and you can watch. It's the brightest thing in the sky when it goes by. It's awesome.
Isn't it beautiful? Well, it's amazing. It's remarkable how many people are unaware of that.
Yeah, it's really cool. All right.
People to look up. And just the last point of that is, for all these people who are involved in collecting these surface samples, I mentioned some of the NFL and NBA teams we worked with. We also worked with Pop Warner, which is a football and cheerleading organization,
yeah.
A fairly large one. So all those teams involved in collecting microbes that will be flying on the International Space Station, to me, I know how excited I am. I can't wait to see the space station, especially when I know that microbes that we're working on will be up there.
You'll be telling your kids, our microbes are up there. Look at that right now. All right, so, Darlene, I have a few more questions with you. Hold on for 1 second. I want to find out about Science Cheerleader, about this organization that Darlene founded. Also, she's working with Discover Magazine. They've got a cool partnership called Citizen Science Salon. I want to find out what that's all about. That'll be next. Matt Bubala, Radio 720, WGN here with you till 2 a.m. Here with you all week on the 11P to 2A shift. Our rounding, rotating guests, series of hosts, hanging out with new producer Keith. Well, what does Patty keep calling you? I know you posted on Facebook that she was calling you the wrong name. You posted something like one of the first nights you worked with Patty about how cool this was, except Patty kept calling me.
She called me Keith Gordon.
Keith Gordon.
And then she also called me Kevin at one point.
Well, I just called you Pete, so I got one in there, too.
Pete Conrad, though? Because he was an astronaut, so that would be kind of
really?
Cool.
Really? See?
Yeah, Pete Conrad.
All ties together. I planned it. Really, I knew what I was doing the whole time. So, anyways, to reset, Matt Bubala with you, Radio 720, WGN. Darlene Cavalier is on the phone with us. We're talking about Sue's microbes and all these other microbes being launched to the space station, see how they react in space, see how it's different from microbes that are in a very controlled environment in the International Space Station. But I also want to talk with you, Darlene, about a couple other things. So we mentioned Science Cheerleader. That's a group you helped found. You're a former Philadelphia 76ers cheerleader. And so what is the group exactly? You and a bunch of other cheerleaders who are pursuing science as a profession or as a hobby, or what is it?
Yes, I'm the only one without a formal science degree, but I get to be a science cheerleader because I founded the group. So we're probably up to 275 members of this organization now who are former or current NFL and NBA cheerleaders. We're starting to branch out into the college realm as well. And they are all pursuing what's called STEM careers, science, technology, engineering, and math careers. Some that are extremely impressive have advanced degrees, multiple degrees. We have one science cheerleader named Talmisha formerly of the Washington Redskins, and I believe she was on the Ravens before that. I lost count after like 4 or 5 degrees. It ended with her PhD in molecular medicine from Johns Hopkins.
Wow.
So she's a wonderful science cheerleader for us. In fact, one of the principal investigators of the Project Mercury research project that we've been talking about, also known as Space Microbes, is Wendy Davis. So she's an NFL cheerleader. She had been an NBA cheerleader, and she's pursuing her PhD now at UC Davis. She is one of the researchers working on this project.
Is part of the idea to break a mold or a stereotype about cheerleaders that they're just beautiful blondes who aren't so smart? Is that part of the reason why you guys have grouped together?
Yeah, that's half of it. Thank you for bringing me back to the mission of the organization. So that's right. They playfully challenge stereotypes And that means different things to different people. So you just brought up one stereotype, and that tends to be about the cheerleaders and what people think about cheerleaders, that they're just, you know, dumb. And that's a really, it's a very harmful message to youth cheerleaders.
Yeah.
And for anybody who doesn't take that seriously, just the numbers are staggering. There's an estimated 3 million little cheerleaders in the United States. So reinforcing the stereotype that being, you know, perky or cute or however you want to label cheerleaders equals dumb is just not doing anybody any good. On the flip side, we have lots and lots of stereotypes embedded in what it means to be a scientist or an engineer. So we hope that we're kind of playfully challenging both of those stereotypes.
Yeah, it really is two tough stereotypes, isn't it? Because,
yes.
You know, and it's quite honestly, I think it's beautiful people in general get looked at like, well, they got through life by looking that way, and so they don't have the smarts that go with it. And that's just kind of a, probably our us not so good looking people like to look at you and say, well, you're not smart. I know that at least. And we have that at least on our side. But then the scientists are all geeks and nerds and dorks, and we all think that. So you're really, you're tackling two things at once.
Exactly. And a lot of it's just about empowering young girls in particular to just, you know, using the science cheerleaders as a living examples of saying, be all that you can be. Just let yourself determine your path. And they're very honest, too. When they talk to youth cheerleaders or anybody else, really, they'll always say, you know, a lot of it comes down to good time management skills.
Yeah.
And none of this is easy. I mean, it actually is not an easy thing to be an NFL or an NBA cheerleader, despite what people might think there. Imagine the time management skills to be in school, getting your PhD in a medical field or an engineering field, and having the time to put in, you know, three rehearsals a night. And then in my case, with the NBA back then, I think it was something like 54 home games.
And not make much money doing that, right? I mean, that's like, that it wasn't like bringing home the bacon just doing the cheerleading, was it?
No. But I mean, I think anybody who goes into that understands, like, it's less than a part-time job.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's fun. It's fulfilling. It's a great way to give back to your community.
And you're performing. You're fulfilling a dream that most people have to perform in front
of
people.
That's right.
All right. I only have a minute left. So tell me real quick about Citizen Science Salon. It's a partnership with Discover Magazine and SciStarter. Give me the elevator pitch on what that is.
Okay. So the sister site of Science Cheerleader is called SciStarter. So it's a riff on Kickstarter, but instead of asking people to donate money to science, we ask them to donate their talents and their time. So we have something like 750 research projects, and they're all aggregated and sorted in ways. If you came to the site and said, show me what I could do, you know, in Chicago with my kids that has something to do with birds or fishing or whatever topic you like, we would serve up to you opportunities to actually get involved in formal research projects. There are at least 750 researchers looking for help from the public to do anything from, well, Project Mercury is a great example of a citizen science project. Here are researchers at UC Davis, you know, the three or four of them in that lab who say, there's no way in heck we're going to be able to collect 4,000 samples ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they put it out to the crowd. So that's a great example of a citizen science project. SciStarter has all these projects. Every appearance that a science cheerleader does, by the way, she activates a citizen science project. So she'll go out, she'll talk to the crowd about, you know, about her career, letting people know that people from all walks of life still have opportunities to engage in science, and in fact, science needs them, and they use citizen science projects as an example. What we're doing with Discover Magazine, and I'm so excited about it, and in fact, since it's, let's see, something like almost 2 o'clock in the morning here, I can tell you this is live now, today's the first day, that Discover Magazine and SciStarter's partnership is live. So it involves the first of its kind print online social media campaign that allows people to read an article in Discover Magazine. And so this is reaching, you know, something like 6.5 million readers each month. You read an article. At the end of that article, we have opportunities for you to take action on those topics. So it might be you might have read an article about the ruby-throated hummingbird, and lo and behold, here's a reference where you can get involved in a research project involving the ruby-throated hummingbird or microbes or whatever the topic would be.